What we're doing in this course, I don't know about you, but half the teachers are here. Half the classes are other people that are teaching. So I just told you that to shake you up a little bit. But how did this course come about? Well, I did a thing 2 weeks ago on radical discipleship. And I used a little bit of M. Scott Peck. In his book, Different Drum, he talks about patterns of transformation and why people do or do not reach a more spiritual maturity. And somehow we were talking about that in a session, and Gail and I gave me a good book to read, Seasons of Strength by the Whiteheads, New Visions of Adult Christian Maturing. I read it through and I thought, gee, this is great stuff. Why don't we do a class on it? And so we decided to offer a class this week. That should tell you that we're much more learners in this area than we are experts. But that's not going to deter us, because I find that it's fun to take something and have to grow to do it. And some of you will be very helpful to us in offering additional insights, because some of you come from backgrounds that may be more profound than ours. I am a simple parish pastor. I did get a doctorate, including some things in developmental psychology, but I can't say that this is my field. And Gail is a nurse who deals with people who have all kinds of physical problems, but sometimes they're much more than physical. They're mental, spiritual, whatever in nature. Let me just throw out a couple of thoughts. Why don't people reach maturity? Peck talked about probably a majority of people in our congregations reach what he calls a level 2 maturity, as over against level 4 maturity, which is sort of a more full-blown spiritual maturity. And he says it's because they've come from an undeveloped spiritual state. They've had some kind of rewarding experience that has religious significance for them. They do come to a set of beliefs. They come to a set of behavior patterns. They develop some kind of worship life, a liturgical or that's meaningful for them. But then they sort of stagnate at that point. They become rigid about those things. And instead of moving on, They adhere very tightly to these patterns that have become helpful to them at that point and were good in themselves. But then those very habits become blocks against further growth. People, on the other hand, who for whatever reason sense are able to move on, and of course many children in families that have this type of rigid, formalized religious orientation, many of the children start asking questions about that. They realize this has kind of been imposed on them. It's given them a lot of stability. But then they begin to question, but this is not sufficient for me. I need more. I want something beyond this. And he talks about what he calls level 3 as a searching, growing state. And then either, such people either usually move on to a level 4 maturity, or they return to their, what he calls level 2, or maybe even worse, to an unspiritualized state. But hopefully they move on to a level 4. And a couple of characteristics of that type of maturity. It's communal, that is, it accepts diversity in others. It celebrates, in fact, differences rather than insisting on agreement, on conformity to this set of beliefs or this set of behavior patterns or whatever it is. It doesn't have rigidity and accepts other people without conditions. It doesn't condition acceptance of others. It's mystical, he says. That is, it senses a unity in almost that everything has some relationship to everything else. There's a connectedness to all things in life, and that you don't touch the universe, you don't touch a person's life in one spot without touching everything else in the universe or in that person's life. It's mystical, and it doesn't accept boundaries to beliefs or what you belong to or what's acceptable. And the maturity of it is it accepts imperfections in himself and accepts imperfections in others. It accepts imperfections in institutions. You know, spiritually mature people, for instance, probably belong to some church or some religious grouping, because everybody doesn't have to be perfect. They don't have to make judgments about everybody. They can even listen to sermons by us pastors that sometimes are pretty dull, boring, you know, but they might learn something. And so they're willing to tolerate the intolerable just because they might find something useful and worthwhile. That's a more mature type of spirituality. And these people see faith as a spiritual life, as a journey. It isn't something they've come to and now they got a station they're going to hold to it. But it's a journey, progressing, moving, always. In fact, such people deliberately try to empty themselves of set ideas, set understandings, so that it makes room for fresh understandings and reorganization of that which they already hold to. And so rather when they hear something, instead of making a quick judgment, is it okay or not okay, that they want to empty themselves of it, of what they're presently holding, to entertain this fresh view. Maybe there's something worthwhile, good, maybe I can learn something, maybe I can move on to something better. And of course, then they continue to use what they've had, but momentarily emptying themselves. Well, this is, as I read this book, and somewhat we're going to follow some of the ideas in this, this is kind of the framework in which I've put a lot of ideas. Now, Gail, we're going to turn it over to you.
Okay. And, well, I believe strongly that our stages of development as people going from the child through old age are congruent with our stages of development in our Christian life. I am going to refer to Erik Erikson's stages of development. Did anyone else want a copy of this? And we're basically, today we're going to kind of focus on the child. But just kind of looking at the, I believe that if you do not complete, you know, we all go through, you know, we're children, we're adults, and we go into old age and we die. But many of us do never really move on through these developmental stages into maturity. Many of us operate, at times we all operate in a child, you know, be like a child, or we might act like an adolescent or so forth. But, you know, the ultimate goal is to be able to reach maturity. And I know sometimes for myself, when I, before I maybe got more educated and had more experiences in life, I had some problems with probably staying in the infancy stage, which was learning how to trust. And I know that as a nurse, many of the people that I see in the hospital when they are ill, in crises or whatever, do refer it back to, you know, their trust issues, allowing you to get close to them. Myself, I have had some problems with that myself in order to be able to allow myself to be vulnerable and to move out of that stage. And if we don't, as a child, get those needs met, then we mistrust people. I think that also goes along in our Christian life. So these tasks of development also are, you know, cross over into where are we in our Christian life, and that's kind of what I'm, you know, trying to show here. Early childhood, we start, you know, we depend on others for our emotional needs as an infant, and we move on into the, when children are about 2 or 3, they start trying to become independent, trying to be autonomous, and move on to trying to do some testing the water, so to speak. If that task is not met, they have shame and doubt. They still are not really moving on in that stage of development. When they get into the school age, well, play, school age, we start to learn things, try to figure out things, experience, testing, doing different kinds of experiences, growing through those stages. Into the teenage stage, which is the identity stage, dating, finding out who we are, that self-esteem, self-identification stage. Then young adult is intimacy. Many times at that stage, people are thinking of getting married, starting families. And Erikson's, I see people in that young adult stage where they're starting their families, they're, you know, working hard, becoming, raising their children and so forth and so on. And I think for a lot of people that can be very, task is not, that you don't move on to that, I see a lot of people where when I was working in my job with isolation and loneliness, where they really had a very difficult time letting people get close to them and being vulnerable to allow people that closeness again. Maturity, where we all kind of want to reach, is being productive. And the strength is care. If that need is not met, we have aimlessness. And then old age, and it takes a long time to get the wisdom, which is the strength, integrity. And I would say in my experience with people in the hospital that there are a lot of people that get to old age that do tell me about a lot of their despair. They feel very alone and isolated, and so those are Erikson stages of development. I would like to, I believe that it's a process. It doesn't just, it takes all of us a long time to go through these stages. But focusing on the child, I believe that many of us lose that childlike as we're going through these stages. We forget, we get so focused on achievement and moving on that myself included, we forget to be like a child. And that being able to be dependent. As Christians, we confess a profound dependence on God. And as children, we learn to trust the power of this, and that we need to be able to trust God, and we also need to be able to trust others. And I think that that's a difficult, sometimes that's very difficult. For me it is, to be able to just be vulnerable, to be able to actually be like a child and be able to trust others, to be able to give to others. But as a child, you know, we're so honest and open, but also to let others take care of us. You know, I don't think that our culture really perpetuates the fact that we should be strong and we should, you know, achieve and we should do all these things and not be vulnerable and be like the child and let that part of the child come out in us. And if we do, I think sometimes we get made fun of. You know, while you're acting like a little child, or, you know, why are you being like that? I'm talking more from my own experience and from what I see in my work and so forth. I am not really very, I have not been extremely involved and active in a church environment a lot. So, it's not something that I'm able to be an expert on in that realm. So Jerry can probably talk more from that point. Also, I think one of the things that I noticed last night, and I'd like to just talk about it briefly, is that one of the characteristics of the child is playfulness. And I think a lot of times, we as Christians in the church, from what my experience has been, is that we really don't, we aren't playful. But I noticed this woman back here and myself last night, we were being very playful. We were having a great time. We were dancing. We were shaking the, you know, the drums were playing. It was great. I mean, I just had the greatest time last night. And I thought, you know, why don't we do this more in the church? Anyways, my experience. And, you know, to laugh and to clap, everything seems so, you know, so serious and so boring in the church to me at times. And I think in our lives we do that way too, because we feel like we have to make this money, we have to achieve, we have to be serious. You know, if we're act stupid, or not stupid, but somebody would call it that, then, you know, we are really not being productive. And I really don't believe that God wants us to be that way. It doesn't, I've never really had, it doesn't, from my experience in reading the Bible or going to church, it never, I've never really heard any ministers, anyone say that Jesus was very playful, or how was he when he was a child. It seemed like he was more serious.
Now, Ron Burke was here a few weeks ago, and I wasn't, but he had talked about the humor of Jesus and the playfulness of Jesus. And I'm sure you get his tapes. It's one of his things.
I see. B-I-R-K.
There's a good book in the library by Elton Trueblood. The what is it called?
I know.
The Humor of Christ, it's called. Yeah. Humor of Christ.
But I don't think that, for myself personally, I have never really heard ministers ever say that or anything. It seems like it's like more of the, you know, you should be good and you should do this, but not really be playful and laugh and have a good time. And Whitehead talks about that part of the playfulness is imagination. And I thought last night, just listening to some of the songs, listening to Ray with his song, I love his song about the when he was 6 years old and he put Anne in. And I mean, that was great. And so Jesus said, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven, which comes from Matthew 18, verse 3. And so I like to suggest or have us participate in thinking about how can we outgrow childhood and move on but also simultaneously make our return in our Christian life and also in our outside or our general activities with others back to, you know, being a child. I think that we really have lost that. And I know for me, it's still real hard that I tend to not always want to be like a child, but be more serious. And when I do that, it really feels good and I have a great time. I have some more to talk about.
Go ahead.
I think that too, that there are some temptations that happen when we move out of childhood, and one of those is, as I talked about before, is to, we tend to want to become our own person. We become too individualistic. And we try to be strong enough to go it alone. I can handle it myself. I don't need any help. I'll just be fine, and isolate ourselves. And which we then tend to abandon imagination and play in our, probably in our churches, within our families. The great American stereotype is an adult who is serious, independent, earnest achiever who can do it alone. And people are really rewarded for that in our culture. Then there's also the other part, and I certainly have seen this in my place of employment, which is that tendency to stay too long because you're afraid of failure or afraid to move out. And after 15 years of working in a large hospital, I finally realized, and it took me a long time, to see where the institution is that paternalistic situation, that hierarchy, and you cannot be creative. You cannot try to test the waters and so forth, because you will be reprimanded, and you stay stuck in this institution, because you have to go. You can be creative. If you do try to move out, you get put down. You get knocked down, and so you become that little child that is not real healthy, because you're treated like, well, they're the parent and you're the child. And I think that a lot of people in the church put their ministers in those positions. They don't really want to try new things. They want the minister to be up here and they'll be the children down here. And yet myself, I've done that a few times, thinking that it's the minister, but not, the people in the church, the congregation.
It is just possible, just not very likely, but some of us ministers do like to play the paternalistic role, and we want to control and manipulate it. That's a temptation that I'm afraid happens all too often.
Yeah. Yes. So to move out of that it's very freeing, but it takes a lot of courage, and it's difficult to be able then to move on and be more, bring that back into our lives, the more creativity, the imagination, and to go on to other things in our life. And sometimes that means, for me, at this point in my life, I have left the church. I mean, I still have my spiritual life, I still believe in God, but the church that I was in, I found it was being very paternalistic, was not moving on, it was not meeting my needs, and now I'm moving on, and I don't know where I will go. And it's kind of lonely, and I'm at Holden now here, so it's kind of a transition time, but where I will go, and what I will find and how I can impact, I feel will be different than where I was before. Whitehead says, for Christian survival, the child has significance. All of our lives, we remain children of God and are dependent on the Creator's love. And I think that's about all I have right now to Jerry.
Let me give a couple things and then let's get some interaction here. Whitehead Gray grounds a lot of this in sort of visions, images of creation. He talks about the image of creation as something we inhabit, something that is worked, something being played. The first says, creation is something we inhabit. God did it, it's done, it's completed. Now we just fit in, play our little role, but everything's worked out, it's done and finished. To see creation as a as something that is worked understands God is really an industrial maker who worked 6 days creating everything, and now we're supposed to work at it too by the sweat of our brow, and above all, since it's work, it isn't play, it's serious business, and you got to toe the line and go at it. But to see creation as something being played is to see life and the universe as something that God is in the process of developing. The wisdom literature steps in here and says that wisdom was present with God as companion and was there as all things were made, and danced with the whole creative process. Here, Shakespeare sees play as all the world's a stage, and then it sees play as there are certain roles that written, we just play it out. Well, a different understanding of play is where you aren't handed a script. There's a situation, but you have to improvise. You have to come up yourself with what it means to take part in that situation, to play at it. He is, of course, arguing for a more playfulness about life. He uses Erickson's understanding of that a child at play, he sees it in terms of a child leaps just for the sheer joy of it, the delight of it. Not because it's something he's expected to do, but, you know, he just likes to jump. For the delight of it. The only purpose of anything is to drive his parents crazy, you know, to make them mad. Sometimes parents think that because they're so exuberant about their playfulness. But then play also has, not its delight, but its testing of the limits, or as he testing the leeward. That is, always, well, in play, you leap, but there's a limit to how much you can do it, but you're always challenging that limit. How can you go higher? Can you go further? And the playfulness of an adult is to challenge the roles we've been given, to question, you know, the situation we're put in. Always, not growing stagnant in what we do, but to keep trying to grow beyond the set pattern that's been handed to us. And then he talks, the third thing Erickson talks about is the jump, the delight of leaping, the testing of the limits of it, and then failing, falling. You fall when you leap. And life is made up of a lot of failures and falling. And of course, that can either make you afraid to play, afraid to leap, or if you've learned to manage falling, then that's part of life itself. And he talks then about, well, that part of the task. For instance, we need an environment to learn to play. The first environment, of course, is the family. And the parent who who encourages this delight, this leaping, that's an important parenting task in a sense. And the child will test parents. How far can they go? And parents' job is to set some boundaries. There are some, you better not leap out into the street. You're probably liable to get run over. There's some boundaries that are set up, but always with some flexibility that those boundaries are allowed to be enlarged and to grow as the child, as they test the limits, keep pushing further and further their own abilities. And then the fall aspect that the parent is there to encourage the child when they fall. They don't, if a child is poked fun at for failure, if their demeaning in their attitude towards the child, why do you always break the dishes when you try to help us wash the dishes? Why do you always fail? Well, of course, the child will begin thinking of the fall, failure, as something of who I am, my identity. And that person, we see them in teenagers and in life, as the person who, I am a person who fails and falls. They're not given permission to fall, encouraged to get up and do it again for the delight of it. And so it's to see falling and failing as integral to learning and life and playfulness itself. Not only is there need then for a family environment to encourage us, encourage the child in play, but all of our life we need that family to enable us to, if we're going to be playful in adulthood, hopefully family is a place to play. And we need a community of support in play. And talked a little bit about what would the church be if the church was a community to offer support in our playfulness. We need a place to fall. You know, you come home at the end of the day and you need a place to crash against all the expectations of, you know, the world, work world. Well, the home ought to be a place to crash. The church ought to be a place to crash, to fall. So that rather than being this paternalistic church that has all the little children in it, where, of course, mistakes are not tolerated, we're expected to be perfect. Well, if we have a community that encourages playfulness, and some failings themselves are essential to growth, to the experimentation of growing, and we aren't reprimanded for the fall. We're acknowledged to look at them. You know, are they healthy? If we don't want to fall the next time, what do we? You know, how do we? What are we going to do to protect ourselves against failings? But failings are not are permitted, and seeing the church, supportive community, as a place to practice this playfulness in life. Well, I'm going to stop talking, and we have a couple of questions to throw, but we'd like to leave it open for a little bit. What would you throw in some further insights or any questions that folks might have? How do you...
Well, of course, as we look at these eight stages of life, and I believe they're a good guide to help us understand what we should be going through, I doubt if there are many adults who look at this and say, oh my God, you know, I missed infancy. I didn't develop trust, so I can see a lot of despair in my life, and oh my gosh, you know, early childhood, free will, oh, but I feel so inferior, I don't dare say what I want to say, and no, I'm no good. So we can look at this growth chart, and I think most people can see where we're hung up on some of these things. So the question then comes, what do we do when we realize this is what the should be of life, but the reality, you know, may be entirely different? And I found some real insight in probably the most maligned philosopher, maligned by the Christian church, who who's helped me to grow tremendously, and that's Nietzsche. I just discovered him relatively recently in my life, and he begins his classic book, Thus Spake Zarathustra, with a metamorphosis. And I think when we come to the point of, okay, there's a lot of failure in my life, there's this and that, and this and that, and the other thing, what do I do then? Nietzsche has these suggestions, and I think they've spoken to me at any rate. He says, the first thing you got to do is you got to become a camel. And he uses the image of a camel, the beast of burden. You've got to come to the place in life where you realize that a lot of crud has been thrown your way. It's just there. I mean, that's reality. And some of the things that he suggests that means taking on the burden of your existence is that when you're really hurting, and you're really in misery, tell it to a deaf man. Now think about that.
Good.
Tell it to a deaf man. When you think back of the height of a great achievement, something you're really proud of, say it's like the croaking of the frogs in the pond. You look at your life and you realize, okay, a lot of bad stuff, but that's my life, like a camel, I take it upon my burden, upon my back. Then you're at the second metamorphosis, which is the lion. And unfortunately, this is a totally parenthetic statement. Nazi German took Nietzsche, when he talked about the lion, they translated it to be the blonde. The lion being blonde, superior race, and completely misconstrued Nietzsche. Nietzsche was far harder than Germans than any other group of people. I mean, he really didn't like him. Didn't like the Germanic race at all. Didn't like that part of himself in it. But anyway, the lion is the strength that you arrive within, where you finally come to the point where you say, I will, and not I should. That's what you're feeling so frustrated about, because you live in the environment, as all of us who have worked inside of an organization, whether it's a hospital or a church or a business corporation, I mean, it's everything I should, I should, I should. But the lion finally says, I will. You got to pay a price for that. But, okay, the burdens are on my back. I accept the burdens for what they are through the grace of God, as the spirits have mentioned here. Now I will. And the I will is very open, because you don't know where it's going to lead to. So he says the final metamorphosis is to become a child. And he says the main thing about a child, he doesn't talk much about playfulness. He talks about the openness of the child. The openness to new experience. The willingness to see the light instead of the shadow. The willingness to trust, exactly what Erickson says, but he provides a means of going back to those parts of our development that we might have missed and finally coming to the point and saying, okay, you know, I'm not going to blame anybody, I'm not going to feel sorry for myself, I'm just going to be a camel, which then allows him to become a lion, and when I say I will instead of I should, then I can become a child. It's interesting.
Good.
I find Nietzsche to be extremely Christian. not at all. You know, he says some horrible things, I mean, but one has to understand the context in which they were said.
Excellent.
Who can follow Nietzsche? No, but I've always felt with Erickson, too, that it isn't a stage of development from one to the other as much as it is. I mean, we know that happens too developmentally, but I think it's a reoccurring and a re-experiencing, and I think that emphasis of his is much what he's saying here, that we are, all of us at times in despair, all of us are at times feel misfit or feel like we are inferior in some way or another. Maybe that's the way we were felt in the church or whatever, you know, or at a wedding, I'm sitting alone and my husband's doing a thing and I don't know anyone, I feel a misfit. I mean, you know, all of us have these times that we feel that every day, in every way. It's not as much a developmental thing as it is an experiential thing. It's ongoing. And which ones are we emphasizing, which ones are we celebrating, is up to us. And which ones are we asking for grace to deal with?
I first came across this developmental idea as in educational theory, the developmental tasks that tend to arise at different ages, simply because that's the appropriate time for facing that kind of particular experience that ought to enable us then to develop healthily so we can go on to the next and to the next and the next. And if we successfully meet that task, in a sense, that life gives to us, then we're better prepared to meet the broadening tasks that lie ahead. On the other hand, if we fail to meet that well, it affects how we meet the next task we have, and the next one. That doesn't mean that later on, we'll have to deal with that in some way, and we can. We're not hooked for life, although it'll always have its effect for life. Somewhere in my development, this whole American attitude, you got to be strong, independent, if you're a man especially, can't be too dependent on others. I've always had to wrestle with that and to be vulnerable to others. To be, I shouldn't be dependent, I need to be independent. I have to struggle to allow myself to be dependent on others, so that the kind of interdependence we have is a strength. And I have to wrestle with that all the time. It's just, you got to do it. You got to be ready to stand alone. So that I know this in my mind, but in my guts, I'm still working at it. So I think this whole development idea is not something that happens and then forget that, write it off. You never, these are continual, lifelong tasks and hurdles or steps or growth possibilities.
Is it to say that we maybe can, at these times, are the times that it's most likely, developmentally, we are first learning the techniques of this, dealing with this particular problem that we will reuse over and over and over again, every foundation, every day, in every, many times all our lives. And if we learn good techniques at that stage, then those techniques serve us well. And if we don't, we have to struggle more with how we deal with that feeling when it comes up again, or that level. Of,
yeah. As a little child, we're obviously dependent. You are dependent. And so if the one we're dependent on, parents, if they're trustworthy and dependable, they allow us to be dependent but without stifling us. But if, on the other hand, our parent is manipulative of us, or they're judgmental as we, in our dependence, are not permitted to make mistakes, or then we learn how to live, how can we fool them so that we're acting as though we're dependent on them, but we're trying to outsmart them. They don't think this, but this is what they're acting. They learn ways to cope with that kind of...
It's a technique that isn't quite as effective as being able to experience that and know that that too is okay.
Right, because they're not free. They have to be on guard, lest they be offensive, and
Bettelheim helps us to understand something in there. He was a child psychiatrist at UFC. He said we need to distinguish between play and games.
Yeah,
he said play is the unstructured, unsupervised experimenting by the child. Games always prescribed, supervised by adults, controlled by adults. Child is not allowed to go outside the rooms. And we don't have enough play in America in too many games.
Welcome to Little League. We don't play here, it's a game. Or we're serious about it and you got to win. And
right, absolutely. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. By the way, not all Little Leagues say that. I, I had some very good associations in it, but there are always people who want to twist it into something other than the play experience, which is not just frivolity. Play is a terribly important and, in a sense, it's serious, but...
Yeah, because we're starting off with using a word that we've never defined, and we're talking about, I think, spiritual maturity. And, you know, we can use psychological categories, you know, of where you get in maturity. But, you know, what is maturity? And I think what I've heard Gail say, and what I had jotted down before she said it, that certainly in the Christian life, the childlike faith is recommended. And Paul talks about spiritual maturity, but yet, you know, what does that mean? And I think we have to define maturity in a spiritual sense differently from psychological.
And who wants to get the maturity of old age here, where we're aimless
and indifferent? Yeah, I guess I find for myself that I feel that my maturity, and I'm not, I would say I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, is that if the example of Jesus Christ is my spiritual, you know, trying to not put conditions on people, but to try to accept people unconditionally and value and respect. If I don't see, I guess I really didn't, I sometimes, not just in the church, but other places, and I think that's probably, you know, that spiritual and spiritual maturity to feel like accepting and love of yourself, self-love, but also to be able to give to others, and that whole thing in the name of religion, for me, this is my own opinion, I see so many people that use religion by putting all these conditions on people. You know, if you are not this, you know, if you are this or that, or if you're divorced, or if you're a lesbian, or if you're homosexual, if you're black, I believe that God said all people are equal. And, you know, when you are putting all these things on other people, you have low self-esteem and you really don't aren't a mature person. And I'm not saying that I don't do that, because we're all human and we all have our failings. But that, to me, is what, you know, is Christian and adult maturity. And children are that way. Children accept people, they don't put conditions. It's as we keep going and taking and getting all this baggage from wherever. And that's why I think we have to try to return to that childlike. I don't know if that.
I wanted to, Whitehead gives a couple of questions for reflection, and let me just kind of repeat them. Where did each of us have a leap in our own spiritual growth? What are some of the leaps, the sheer, you know, that were delightful parts of our own spiritual growth? Where do I now continue to delight in my own life? In other words, where does the playfulness take part in my life, the delight of life? And then, where do I test the limits in my adult life? Where am I testing limits in my spiritual growth?
Good questions.
And then,
Good questions, Jerry.
Yeah. I'm telling her I have trouble hearing these days, and I sometimes don't hear anything. What falls in my life have been important for my growth and maturity? When you fall, you got to learn something. You got to grow. And then I thought it was rather important. Am I a contributor to a playful community now? Is my family a playful community? Is my church a playful community? Am I a contributor to it, I think? Or where am I a contributor, how am I a contributor to a playful community? If the church, one of its characteristics ought to be a playful community that encourages people to leap for the sheer delight of it, or encourages people to test the limits of their own spiritual growth, or if the church is a place where people can fall without condemnation and can be supported and be encouraged to get up and dance again, it isn't... We ought to be a part, we ought to not only be a part to take from that, we need to be givers and participants and contributors to a playful community. And I think that might be a good just test of our own sensing. If we have, if we've retained the childness in ourselves, or, and tomorrow at this time we're going to be talking about what he calls the disciple stage, the tendency in the disciple stage, because it's a, you know, you're striving to be, you know, your zeal for your vocation, or zeal for your family, or zeal for whatever it is, you're really pretty serious about it. You tend to squeeze out the childishness. And he talks, you know, that there needs to be a continual recovery of playfulness. And so that...
It's time.
I'm sorry. So those some thoughts, right?
Can you read those questions real quick?
Yes.
Can you read those questions real quick?
Oh.
Where have I been experienced beliefs in my life? What have I... where have I tested the limits?
Well, the second one is, where do I continue to delight in my life? Third one is, where do I test the limits in my adult life, in my spiritual growth? And fourth, what falls have been important parts of my maturing? And then finally, where or how am I a contributor to the playful community?
Thank you.
Anything else before we wrap it up? Tomorrow, here again, same time, same station. We will talk about the disciple.
Mm-hmm. Only Jerry. Wasn't that book written by Mr. and Mrs. Whitehead?
I was going to say Jerry. But it was not just he, it was they.
Did I say he?
Yeah.
I'm going to read it. I'm going to wear my button that says they.
I am sure at one point I said the white hen.